what kinds of considerations are relevant in doing that? Well, I think I wanted to distinguish three different considerations. First is perhaps the most important. Quantum theory is a scientific theory, so we should always be alert to the possibility it might fail. We should always be trying to test it as severely as possible. And we need a landscape to give us a structure within which to do that. Here, I'm not just talking about generalizations of quantum theory, but alternatives to quantum theory, which don't look like generalizations of it. Maybe one of them will turn out to be right, and quantum theory will turn out to be wrong. We would only find out about that through experiment, presumably. A second kind of motivation is more sort of philosophical. A lot of people over the years have felt disquiet about quantum theory. Maybe they're paradoxes or conceptual incoherences or ineliminable imprecision in our statement of the theory. David, when he talked about the measurement problem, raised the stakes and thought, well, maybe the theory simply doesn't lead to any predictions at all, in which case it's clearly not a very good theory, even from a predictive point of view, from a certain perspective on how to understand the theory. And finally, you might think, well, there's nothing wrong with quantum theory. It just doesn't do what I want a good theory to do. It doesn't answer certain questions, which I think are important questions for a scientific theory, especially a fundamental scientific theory, to be answering. I think the first motivation is clearly unproblematic. Anybody who comes up with an alternative to quantum theory is helping us better to test quantum theory, no matter what their motivation, no matter what it comes from. The second motivation I consider myself, and this is my claim to marginal originality in the talk, is not a good one. I think that conceptually quantum theory is in fine shape. So if you want to add alternatives to quantum theory, to the quantum landscape, it shouldn't be because you think that there's something really fishy or even worse about quantum theory, and you want to replace it in the end by a non-fishy theory. We'll have examples of that. And thirdly, you might think, well, there's nothing wrong with quantum theory, but I'd like a theory that does more. And maybe quantum theory doesn't, in Feynman's terms, tell us how it can be like that. And I want to know how it can be like that. So if that's true, maybe I want to have some possibilities out there in the quantum landscape with which to replace quantum theory that would or generalize or whatever, that would satisfy my craving to know how it can be like that. And that may also be an important guide to the quantum landscaper. That I'm still unsure about, as you'll see by the end of the talk. Okay, so if we're worrying about testing quantum theory, how could it go wrong? Well, it could go wrong because it fails to lead to any predictions at all. Now, I'm using quantum theory to, in a very broad sense, to include non-relativistic quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, string theory insofar as it is a quantum theory, any form of quantum gravity we come up with. So if as a matter of fact, we don't have a theory of quantum gravity that leads to predictions, and that, as far as I'm concerned, I just know nothing about, although I guess there was a meeting here in the fall on quantum gravity phenomenology, so maybe the double question marks there can be removed and say that's not our actual situation in quantum gravity. But of course, the worst situation is if there's false predictions. And we have to be alert to that possibility, of course. So this section is very short. Landscaping and removal. Okay. We know quantum theory is a great theory and has passed all experimental tests so far. But we can get complacent. We can forget about testing it because it's worked so well. If we want to continue to treat it as a scientific theory, we have to continue severely to test it. And the best way of doing that is to set up a framework of alternatives. Philosophers used to talk about something called eliminative induction as in this context. That the idea is you set up a whole class of theories, the better to test the particular theory which you're interested in against. That would be populating the quantum landscape. And to the extent that you're able to rule out to your own satisfaction all of the alternatives to a theory, that gives you better reason, more justified confidence in believing the theory that you're setting out to test. It's passed the tests. And there are various models of this eliminative induction. Bayesians have given models as to how it goes. I don't want to go into any detail on that. But I've heard people, physicists in particular, say it's kind of hard to do that for quantum theory. It's hard to set up a framework for testing quantum theory against alternatives. It was much easier, at least in the old days, I don't know how things are today, with regard to testing general relativity, where there was a well-defined framework of alternatives. When people were all excited about the possibilities of the Brans-Dickey theory, then we had a whole sort of parameterization of alternative theories. And we could rule out whole classes of them by suitable tests. And general relativity could, if we were lucky, and we were, emerge as the victor in that particular confrontation. But there was a quote the other day, somebody picked up something that Steve Weinberg said back in 1989. It's hard to create serious alternatives to quantum theory. So he then said, and I think I've heard Anton Seilinger say the same thing. So it's not quite so easy to set up a framework for a limit of induction, perhaps in the quantum case as it was with GR. So we need rules, not rules, guidelines as to how to do that, just because quantum theory has exerted such a powerful hold on our imagination. Okay, that much I take to be pretty uncontroversial, so let's try and make it a bit more controversial now. Everybody agrees that quantum theory challenges our physical intuitions, but some people have gone further and said, well, ultimately, there's something rotten in the state of quantum mechanics. There's some conceptual incoherence or unclarity, and that worry's been kind of localized around measurement. We heard David give us a very clear presentation of what's taken to be the measurement problem in quantum theory, and non-locality. And that's been an important motivation for some people behind the development of alternatives to quantum theory. The measurement problem in particular seems to be an important motivation for a number of people. I don't think, let me just say, it's a motivation behind coming up with some kind of a collapse theory. People worried about locality seem to think it's important to consider alternatives to quantum theory, like, for example, Bohmian mechanics, which in that case makes quite clear the nature of this quantum non-locality. Although, of course, that puts fundamental relativistic invariance in doubt in doing so. Okay, that's very general. A bit more specifically, what's the problem about measurement? Well, David told us what the measurement problem was. The quantum state assigned to a system doesn't, in general, describe a unique outcome for a measurement on a system. Is this a problem? David said, yes, clearly. It's a terrible problem. It's the measurement problem. It's been bugging us for all these years. Now, I believe a problem arises only if a system's quantum state is supposed to describe the condition and behavior of that system. If the quantum state is supposed to do something quite different, it's not clear there even is a measurement problem in the first place. And what is it supposed to do? Well, we could all agree that one thing that the quantum state is supposed to do is to generate predictions through the Born rule. Okay, but now if that's all it's supposed to do, there's still a kind of problem with measurement, because the usual way that the Born rule is stated is that it gives us probabilities for measurement results. And of course, Bell famously and quite correctly issued an edict banning the term measurement from any precisely formulated theory, and it doesn't help to replace it by interaction with a macroscopic or classically described device or interaction with a consciousness or anything else like that. You're just making things worse rather than better by trying to cash out talk of measurement in those ways. And that, of course, has prompted the search for a measurement-free alternative to quantum theory, a theory without the observer. Even Karl Popper wanted one of those, but he thought quantum theory already was one. Today, people developing alternatives to quantum theory have been very much motivated, some of them, by the desire to come up with an alternative theory that wouldn't mention the observer. And then there's non-locality. I'm going to be fairly careful about non-locality here, because it's important for my purposes. So let's start off by saying what Bell did prove. He proved that any theory meeting a condition which he called local causality, which I'll give you later just to make it quite clear what the condition was, predicts statistical correlations which are incompatible with quantum predictions that experiments have since thoroughly verified. Of course, there are loopholes and things that people keep trying to plug, and it's an empirical theory. Maybe attempts to plug those loopholes will reveal something interesting. If people weren't worried about non-locality, I think they'd have spent much less time and effort trying to plug those loopholes. It goes beyond the norm for attempts to verify predictions of a scientific theory, I think. Now, some people have concluded that therefore the world itself is non-local, that there are indeed some kind of spooky connections between events, including even space-like separated ones. If there are any connections, however, quantum theory doesn't seem to describe them. And it's even worse, in a sense, from Bell's point of view, it's not even clear that we have a formulation of quantum theory which is precise enough to apply his local causality condition, which, as you'll see, was stated in terms of local viables. And what are the local viables of quantum theory? There's room for dispute. Maybe that provides, yeah.
But then you did say that the viables must include things like the
correct.
Compton coils and outcomes
right.
experiments. So
right.
Assuming that, can't be then applied.
Well, I'm going to talk about local causality in more detail later. He did say that. Whether that automatically makes quantum theory a theory such that one can apply his condition, I'm actually going to dispute. Okay. So maybe that's an additional motivation to seek an alternative to quantum theory, because you're bugged about non-locality in some way. Okay, so here are a bunch of theories which, at least in certain quarters, have been motivated as alternatives to quantum theory by alleged conceptual deficiencies of the theory. We've heard quite a bit about these. I learned at this conference that Steve Weinberg recently has gotten weak at the knees about quantum theory. There is now, in my opinion, no entirely satisfactory interpretation of quantum mechanics. Faced with these perplexities, one is led to consider the possibility that quantum mechanics needs correction. So this seems, in this case, from Weinberg, he's endorsing the intuition that there's something conceptually deficient about quantum theory. I'll give you another quote from him later, which actually expresses a different motivation, but that one seems to be present in this particular quote, even from Steve Weinberg. Okay, so here's my view. Quantum theory has no conceptual rubbish. Properly understood, quantum theory faces no measurement problem. Moreover, a clean formulation of quantum theory may be given without even mentioning measurement. So even the secondary worry that Bohm had can be addressed and satisfactorily removed. Well, we all agree that quantum theory is a wonderfully adapted tool for furthering scientific aims of prediction, control, and explanation of natural phenomena. And it can do that without facing any measurement problem, according to me. And I will say more about this later. This is just a bold claim at the moment. Okay. Any physically situated agent, this is going to be important, may use it for these purposes. And we've been doing that for a long time now, very successfully. In particular, another bold claim, which I'll try to back up later, quantum theory helps an agent locally to explain so-called non-local correlations. So in my view of quantum theory, neither the measurement problem nor non-locality by itself provides a sound motivation for seeking alternatives to quantum theory. Now, of course, you know, given the motivation of getting something out there in the quantum landscape, if you happen to have that motivation, which I don't think you should have, and you come up with some really interesting theory, put it in the quantum landscape and we'll test quantum theory against it. So now say something more positive. I have a few papers already published sort of developing this line. The first one was in British Journal of Philosophy of Science in December 2012. I call this approach pragmatist, not pragmatic, but pragmatist, buying into a tradition in philosophy that goes back to Peirce, James, and Dewey, although I don't believe everything they believed. Okay. So what's the point of a quantum state if it's not to describe the condition and behavior of a quantum system? The point of a quantum state, the main point, is to function as a source of good advice about a system's dynamical properties, things like its position and energy and momentum, and so on. And what you should do if you believe or if you accept quantum theory is to adjust your degrees of belief about properties of things like this in accordance with the Born probability rule. So if it says probability is a half, believe it to degree a half, whatever. Now, if you're interested in something like an interference pattern, you should have an extremely strong degree of belief if you've got enough particle detection events contributing to the pattern. You should have an extremely strong degree of belief that it'll be pretty much corresponding statistically to the probabilities that quantum theory gives. That's a very strong belief. A sufficiently belief-worthy statement, e.g. about what an interference pattern is going to look like, that's a prediction of quantum theory. So that's how we get predictions out of the theory. Okay, now, primitive people go around talking about this distinction between psiontic and psi-epistemic conceptions of the quantum state. And I'm beginning to think that's a little puzzling. I mean, the suggestion seems to be, look, here are conceptions of the quantum state. And over here, we have psiontic. And over here, we have psi-epistemic. And are you a sheep or a goat? Okay, which of these boxes are you going to be put into? Well, I don't think that's a very good picture. Given the way these terms are used, I think the picture should be something more like this. Psi E, Psi O, and everything else. Okay. Or perhaps this might be maybe a more conciliatory view, something like this. Psi E, Psi O, and something in the middle, it's kind of both. That's where I would locate my view of quantum theory. It has aspects which make it look psi-epistemic, aspects that make it look psiontic, but the distinction itself is not very helpful because it suggests that I'm taking a view which is not even on the map. Okay. So what is the view then? If you view the quantum state the way I do, one thing is not true. The quantum state does not describe some special quantum structure that we found out about since we have developed quantum theory. In that sense, the view is not obviously psiontic. But I don't think, like the quantum Bayesians, that the quantum state is supposed to describe or represent the epistemic state of any particular agent. In that sense, the view is not obviously psi-epistemic. So what is it? Well, the sense in which it is psiontic is the following rather trivial sense. In this view, a quantum state is objectively true or false. Either you got it right or you didn't. It's not up to you what to believe. And in that deflationary sense, a quantum state is objectively real. So to that extent, it's psiontic. But the important thing is not what the quantum state describes. That's a trivial and boring question. The important thing is how does it function? Okay. Its function is not to say what the world is like. In that sense, it's not psiontic. It's to help an agent predict and explain what happens in it. That's what the quantum state is supposed to do. And since, for me, it's important that an agent is a physically situated information gathering and utilizing system, different physically situated agents may apply quantum theory to the same system in different ways. They may assign it different quantum states. They may make different probability judgments based on that assignment. That means that quantum state assignments, even though they are objective, are relational. So you shouldn't confuse relationality with subjectivity, which, to my mind, maybe some quantum Bayesians do, but they would reject that complaint and say, no, it really is personalist all the way down. It's an independent point. Okay, if you take this view, there simply is no measurement problem, so we don't have to consider ways of solving it. It never arises in the first place. Think what's going on. You have a single agent, and that agent's situation changes in time because the agent is physically situated without doing anything, just simply as time passes. So that requires, if the agent is going to be in good shape with regard to predicting, explaining, and controlling natural phenomena, that the agent periodically revise its quantum state assignment on gaining access to new information. So that means that collapsing the wave function is not a physical process, it's a required bookkeeping exercise. Required in the sense that you better do it. Okay. Also, since agents can be in different places, where does collapse happen, even in this bookkeeping sense? It happens where they are, when appropriate. It happens on each time-like world line of an idealized, but merely hypothetical agent. They don't have to be any agents in a model where we're trying to apply quantum theory. But in order to apply quantum theory, we have to, as agents, project ourselves into the model and say, well, if that were there, then this is the quantum state I would assign, and this is how I would update things, and this is how I would calculate probabilities.
But yep. Then how would you explain things like quantum Zeno paradox? If measurement is just a bookkeeping, why does it have such a serious role like in quantum Zeno paradox?
I'm going to just postpone that question till later. It's a good question to worry about. Okay, not only is there no measurement problem, there's no secondary problem that we have to state quantum theory using a term like measurement. Why? Well, how do you state the Born rule? You don't even talk about measurements or observations or experiments or observers or macroscopic objects. You just assign probabilities directly to dynamical properties. Now, as soon as I say that, alarm bells are going to go off all over the room. Right? You can't do that. That's what Kochanich-Becker and all those guys showed us. You can do it if you do it, if you apply the Born rule selectively. If you apply it only to certain claims about dynamical properties of systems, rather than try to apply it all across the board. So how does that work? When should you apply the Born rule on this view? Well, you should apply it only to properties of systems which today, I have to say, merely are rendered objective by quantum decoherence. Quantum decoherence is not a process which involves disentangling systems. Entanglement continues regardless from a certain perspective. But it does advise an agent when applying a model of quantum decoherence on the cognitive significance of claims about dynamical properties. And if under that advice, the agent says, okay, well, particular set of claims about the dynamical properties of this particular system in this context, are highly cognitively significant, then it advises the agent to go ahead and apply the Born rule to those claims. So when considering decoherence from this perspective, decoherence is not a physical process, which is described by the Schrödinger equation, even though it is described by the Schrödinger equation, or we apply the Schrödinger equation to get our heads around it. Instead, the quantum state functions as an authoritative source of advice on the cognitive significance of a claim about systems properties. And if it gets cognitively significant enough, then go ahead, apply the Born rule. Now, you can imagine that there won't be circumstances in which the Born rule is legitimately applied to the whole class of propositions about dynamical properties of a system. That's why I'm not bothered by the traditional arguments like Kochanich-Becker's and subsequent developments of that style of no hidden variable argument. Okay, there's a lot more to say about that. I have said more about it in one paper that was published in Foundations in Physics recently, that how decoherence works for me in rendering certain statements cognitively significant. And you can ask me later to go into more detail, but I want to keep going just so that you get the whole picture out front. The next part of the picture is non-locality. And here I have to go a little carefully. I think, along with a bunch of other people, that Bell's clearest argument, formulation of his argument for a form of Bell inequality, in this case the CHSH formulation, is in this late paper, La Nouvelle Cuisine. And there he starts off with an intuitive local causality principle, which is stated as follows. Everything in blue was said by somebody else. Okay, so blame them for that, not me. The direct causes and effects of events are nearby, and even the indirect causes and effects are no further away than permitted by the velocity of light. So in terms of a picture, what would count as potential causes and effects of things in region one? This is a space-time picture, as you can see, with time going up. Well, anything in region three is a potential cause of what happens in region one. Anything in the future light cone of region one is a potential effect, and that's it. Events like two are neither potential causes nor potential effects in accordance with the intuitive local causality principle. Okay, but Bell says that's nice. That's his intuition about local causality, which he thought it was a generalization of local determinism, interesting. But that's not enough to actually get anywhere mathematically. And Bell was a very careful and very thoughtful guy. So he himself said in this paper, that we need to get something precise in order to apply mathematics. But in the step to make intuitive principles mathematically precise, we're in danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So he himself said the next step should be treated with extreme suspicion. But he took it. So what was the next step? A local causality condition, which he formulated. This is a condition which is supposed to apply to a whole class of theories. And it's not a condition on the world, right? That's important to bear in mind. A theory will be said to be locally causal if the probabilities attached to values of local variables, that's his terminology, things which are there independent of observation or, in Einstein's words, substantiation. If the probabilities attached to values of local variables in a space-time region 1, as in the previous diagram, are unaltered by specifications of values of local variables in a space-like separated region 2. When what happens in the backward light cone of 1 is already sufficiently specified, for example, by a full specification of all local variables in a space-time region 3, I've added the parenthetical subscript A for reasons that will soon become apparent. That wasn't his. The point is that we need to say a little bit more if we're going to apply this derive the CHSH inequalities. We need to have a picture that involves a bit more structure than what we have so far. We need to consider regions 1 and 2, and we need to extend the region previously called 3, now in this diagram called 3A, so that it at least includes the region 3B. And, you know, we might as well, while we're at it, extend it all the way across the backward light cones of 1 and 2 for this purpose. So what's going on in this diagram? Think of this, as I will later on think of it, as a scenario in which we're thinking of Alice measuring the polarization of one photon of an entangled pair along the little a axis and getting result big A, and similarly for Bob over here. So the little a, or the big A and the big B, are events occurring in regions 1 and 2. And they can be macroscopic. You know, everybody can be happy that this device really has clicked or whatever. But there also have to be events little a and little b, which involve the event of setting the device to one particular polarization angle over here and over here. And a worry came up in subsequent investigation of this argument by Travis Norson and later paper by Joss Lufink and Mikhail Sevink, which I strongly recommend to you, that this can't be something that's fully specified by what's going on in here. Otherwise, we wouldn't have free choice as to how to set these settings. So Bell's initial condition on what it is sufficient, what would be sufficient to specify what's going on in the back light cone of 1 and 2 can't be quite right. Okay, so read Joss and Michael's paper to get, or Mikhail's paper to have a very subtle and studious discussion of this point. But I hope that gives you the picture of what's going on here. Okay. So then, based on this, we can do mathematics. And this sharpened and cleaned condition now enables Bell to derive these equalities. Let me just read the first one. Given the settings A and B, the probability of Alice getting result A, conditional on Bob's getting result B, and conditional on the specification of local variables in the region 3, is equal to the probability given Alice's setting that Alice gets result A, conditional on the values of these local variables in the region 3. Similarly, for 2, these imply the key factorizability condition, which is required to derive, well, in this case, CHSH inequalities. So that's the way the argument goes. Okay. Now, I'm going to show you how quantum theory enables Alice and Bob locally to explain violations of Bell inequalities without getting into conflict with either Bell's local causality condition, as he has stated it, or even, although this is more controversial, his intuitive local causality principle, which he took to motivate that. So here's the story. We start off with what's going on at T2. And at T2, both Alice and Bob agree that the entangled Bell state phi plus is the right state to ascribe to the photon pair that they have prepared. How do they do that? Well, they have prior information on non-quantum claims, like, well, we set up the laser here, and we set up the down conversion crystal here, and we tested everything out, and we were totally convinced on the basis of lots of results that this really was the state that we had prepared in this way. Okay, then Alice measures polarization of one photon, which since it gives a result we will call photon L, along axis A, and Bob measures polarization of photon R along axis B. Why is either of them allowed to apply the Born rule? Only because decoherence at the detectors has made it cognitively significant for them to contemplate claims about what's happened at each detector. If that were not the case, then they would not have been entitled to apply the Born rule here. But it was the case, so they were, so fine, okay. And they can use it to calculate the probability for each of the possible outcomes of Alice's polarization measurement. That's the one I'm going to focus on, Alice's result. Well, Bob records polarization B for his photon, and then he goes on to ascribe quantum state B, as I've written it, as a vector, to Alice's photon, and uses the Born rule to calculate the probability for Alice to record polarization A for L based on that quantum state. Alice, on the other hand, describes a different quantum state to her photon in this situation and uses the Born rule to calculate a different probability that she will record polarization A for that photon. Each of them, according to me, wisely uses the calculated probability to guide his or her expectation about Alice's outcome. And Alice's statistics in many repetitions of the experiment, so ideally the picture I drew you should be duplicated many, many times rather than just the same picture with one result. And she finds that they're just what her quantum state led her to expect, thereby explaining her results. And Bob does the same thing with his. And his statistics for Alice's outcomes in many repetitions, in which his outcome is B, are just what his quantum state led him to expect, thereby explaining Alice's results. So they both explained Alice's results. They've done it by ascribing different quantum states and by ascribing different probabilities through the Born rule based on those quantum states. And that's how, according to me, each of them uses quantum theory locally, where they were, to explain Alice's results. The point is that there's no question as to which or either of them were right in ascribing the particular quantum state that they ascribed. They were both right, because quantum state descriptions are relational. And also the question as to which of the different probabilities they ascribed gives the real chance of Alice's outcome at T2 simply doesn't arise. There is no real chance of Alice's outcome at T2, even though neither Bob's nor Alice's Born probability is subjective. Born probabilities also are in this way, in their application, relational. Being told what you should have expected and finding your expectations confirmed isn't enough to take it that what you were told explained what happened. You all know the example of reliable barometers that fall, giving us reliable expectations that the storm will come without explaining the coming storm. So I have to say more than what I've said so far to justify the claim that what I've given you is an explanation. And so what I say is this, that in order to explain what's going on, you have to say what that which you're trying to explain depends on. And Alice and Bob have a story about what it depends on. They both agree it depends on whatever was involved in preparing that particular Bell state. And Alice and Bob give different accounts as to what Alice's particular results depend on. Bob in particular takes Alice's results to depend on his results. Alice, however, does not. Notice, by the way, although I haven't said this so far, that the discussion I've given applies independent of the time order of these events in Alice's frame. She happened to be moving really, really fast in the right direction. That would reverse the time order of the events. Wouldn't make any difference. Okay, so Bell talks about beables, and it's really important that Born probabilities are not themselves local beables. They don't represent localized chances. What they are is offers of authoritative, and in this case, different advice to differently situated agents. Tells them what to expect, and thereby explains what they find when they get it. Quantum theory doesn't prescribe a single probability for Alice's measurement outcome in one. It supplies or prescribes probabilities tailored to the local situation of each of them. Now let's go back to Bell's argument. He started off with this intuitive locality principle, and then by a move which he himself asked us to question, arrived at this locality condition. So given the story I just told you, why should a theory attach unique probabilities to values of local variables in a space-time region? After all, quantum theory doesn't. If the theory doesn't attach unique probabilities to values of local variables in a space-time region, then how do we even apply this condition? Because the condition assumes we're dealing with theories that do that. So we have to be careful here. Does quantum theory violate local causality? No. Does causal theory respect local causality? No. Local causality is a condition that cannot be applied to quantum theory. So we can't raise the question, therefore we can't answer it. Okay. That might seem like it's too cheap a way out. What about the intuitive condition? If we go back to that, and following up on your remark about that these things are local variables, what are we going to say about causation here? I admit that there are certain patterns of counterfactual dependence between Alice's result and Bob's result. And people who think those kinds of patterns of causal dependence are sufficient for causation, we're going to say, therefore, you've got causation. They then have to tell us a story about how we can have causation going both ways to get a nice symmetric Lorentz invariant causal story. Or they might introduce this hitherto unknown category of two-way causation to get causation in on the act here. It's beginning to look uncomfortable. I prefer not to talk about causation at all here. The story I told you didn't even mention causation, but it did give us an explanation of the correlations without doing so. So let's just not talk about causation. If we don't talk about causation again, we're never going to be in trouble with the intuitive local causality principle. Okay, so that was my attempt to reassure you that there's no conceptual rubbish in quantum theory. You shouldn't be worried about the measurement problem. You shouldn't be worried about non-locality. The explanation that quantum theory gives us, or helps us to give, I had to be careful in my phrasing, of violations of Bell inequalities involves nothing which looks anything like a violation of a principle of local action, or a violation of relativistic invariance, or causation between space-like separated events, or anything unpleasant like that. But there are various things that quantum theory doesn't give us on my view of quantum theory. And that might still be a niggling worry for you. It is for me. Quantum theory itself doesn't give a continuous space-time description of physical processes on this view. And you might really want that. The reason that we don't have a measurement problem is that a quantum state never describes an observation result in the first place. But you really might want it to do that. You really might want to make the inference from the apparatus in certain circumstances being in an eigenstate of pointing this way to the apparatus really pointing this way. On my view of the quantum state, such an inference in that situation without further description is not warranted. You also might be worried if you think that quantum theory is a fundamental theory, and if it's really a fundamental theory, then it should reduce to classical physics in the appropriate limit. You should be able to recover classical physics from it in an appropriate limit. But if this view of quantum theory is right, since quantum theory is not in the describing business, there's no hope of recovering classical physics as a description from this theory, which is not itself descriptive. And that really might bug you. You might think, well, I thought it was a fundamental theory, so I have to be able to recover classical physics in the limit. Otherwise, I'm really unhappy. Okay. And of course, although we've known this for a long time, quantum theory doesn't explain the particular outcome of an observation, why it's this rather than that. But this last worry doesn't really upset us these days. We've kind of got our minds around that one. We think, nah, the world may be indeterministic, maybe certain questions that the old guys thought that good theory should answer. Quantum theory doesn't answer those questions, but we're no longer trying to answer those questions. We just accepted that's the best we can do, and been thankful for what we can do. So I think that contrast with the worries about these first three issues and the worry about indeterminism that we seem to have got over is an interesting contrast to bear in mind. In any case, back to the quantum landscape. A bunch of people who have got worried, apparently, by alleged explanatory deficiencies of quantum theory. Gerard Hooft has been rummaging around at a basement level with his cellular automaton theory, or automaton theory. I'm not going to talk anything about that. I assume some of you know about it. Those of you who don't know about it, it would be interesting for you to find out. And he said at one point in a recent archive post, we should plainly ask what is really going on in a world described by quantum mechanics. And that's what's bugging him. And that's why he's trying to rummage around in the foundational basement looking for something that would help him out. I believe, although Adrian's here and he can answer this straightforwardly, that part of the motivation behind his, what I call distance modulated Lagrangian model, is to give us a story of what's going on, which is not obviously there in the way we ordinarily think of quantum theory. And I want to talk a little bit about another Lagrangian model. Interesting, if you're really bugged by the measurement problem, you get hung up on what the quantum state is like and when it collapses and how we give an account of how it collapses. If you approach quantum theory from what is allegedly, and I accept this, an equivalent formulation in terms of path integrals, then the wave function doesn't enter. So that particular way of getting your worry on the table is not available to you. Although, of course, you can sneak it back in again if you want because of the equivalence. So here's an alternative Lagrangian formulation. I don't think Wharton is worried by the conceptual problems, but what he does say is this. This is not a mere reinterpretation of quantum theory, but rather an outline of a proposed explanation in the same way that statistical mechanics is an explanation of thermodynamics. And that's the archive posting of a recent paper of his, if you're interested. So I'll say a little bit about this. Maybe I shouldn't. How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. So I'm going to go very briefly through this. Don't bug me with detailed questions. This is not my view. I refer you to the original. I'm not sure I've understood it well enough to answer your questions on this anyway. But here's the general idea. You start from a path integral formulation of quantum theory. You impose restrictions on paths at both ends. Those are the time-symmetric boundary conditions. But importantly, you also impose this thing he calls a null Lagrangian condition, which says that apart from these constraints I was just telling you about, the only restrictions on field variables, this is for a field formulation of a version of quantum theory, is that the Lagrangian density is always zero. Now, that seems like a pretty drastic restriction, and you might worry whether you can ever get away with that if you want to recapture an interesting and significant part of quantum field theory. But let's see what happens if you do. And then he has an equal a priori probabilities restriction. All allowed microhistories have an equal a priori probability. And again, if you're putting probability measures on things, you worry about the justification for doing that. But these are just postulates. Let's see what happens if we do it. Okay. Then he develops a toy spin model, which is not actually a field theory model at all. He puts spins in various places in space and thinks that's kind of a stand-in for a field theory. And he makes this interesting claim about it. For the toy Lagrangian, what results is a realistic, continuous, hidden variable account of what may be happening between spin measurements, even including cases that violate Bell's inequality. To the extent that even this small result has long been thought impossible, realism has new cause for hope. Whether or not this works, I'm not really interested, although he is, and maybe you should be. But what I'm interested in is the motivation for it. It's not to solve some conceptual problem, it's to give us a picture of what's going on in the world, to give us back the realism we crave. So these are his diagrams, so thank you, Ken. I've modified them slightly. I hope he doesn't object to my modifications. So these are paths, right? Time is going this way. And these big, thick paths have the following character. The classical path between A, or something more finely defined within A, and something more finely defined within Y, would be the one for which the action is extremal. But there are lots of paths very close to that, which is why it's such a thick line here, on which the Lagrangian density everywhere varies. Any path, even these little thin ones, is a path, or perhaps in the case of thick paths, a lot of paths, along which the Lagrangian density is everywhere zero. But these paths don't extremize the action. Okay, so this would be, in here somewhere, there would be a classical path, if that had been the initial condition. In here, again, a classical path. In here, a classical path. Moreover, in this case, we've assumed A actually was the initial condition. Okay, so this was what would be going on, and this is what we would have to assign an equal a priori probability measure over all of these paths. And we've lost all of the nasty paths from his point of view, on which the Lagrangian density is not everywhere zero. But to say what we're actually going to see, we have to model a measurement apparatus as well. So we bring in this device. Okay, so the point of this diagram now, you see there's lots and lots of little L equals zero paths linking up with Z, only one linking up with Y, and lots linking up with X. So when we set an equal a priori probability measure on all of these paths, that's going to have interesting implications. We need to say what measurement we're actually going to perform. That's why when we introduced the device, all of these paths appeared, which weren't even thought of prior to that. That gives us a solution space over which we're supposed to give joint probabilities. Once we've got the joint probabilities, we can conditionalize them on whatever information we happen to have. And if we happen to be know that the information of this initial condition is A, then that's going to give us a probability estimate for results X, Y, and Z here. And it's going to be calculated in this way. The probability of getting result X conditional on A is the joint probability of A and X divided by the total probability of A in this scenario. And in this case, even though we might have thought this was the obvious endpoint, even this classical starting point, once we've introduced this measuring device and acknowledged the vast difference in number of paths collecting this to this to the paths collecting this to this, we see that the classically expected result actually doesn't happen. And we get a distribution between these probability for X and probability for Z and a negligible probability for Y. Okay. Now, he's really concerned with the time asymmetry in conventional formulations of quantum theory. And he thinks that an additional conceptual virtue of this approach is that it explicitly restores time asymmetry in the model itself. The only time asymmetry is in the experimenter's knowledge. OK, so that's a model. It might be crazy. It might not work. It's this motivation that I'm interested in rather than anything else. Here's something very wise that Einstein said. You've all seen some of or all of this before. So I just want you to focus on this part that I've highlighted in red. The real in physics is to be taken as a type of program to which we are, however, not forced to cling a priori. Einstein, of course, was a realist. He clung to it. But even he said, you don't have to. If you find something else that works, go for it. Those are my words, of course, not Einstein's. And he himself said of himself that to the epistemologist, he must have seemed like an unscrupulous opportunist. Try anything that works, okay? Realism works, great. If it doesn't, try something else. Okay. Feynman, on the other hand, tells us, do not keep saying to yourself if you can possibly avoid it, but how can it be like that? Which you will get down the drain. I love this mixed metaphor. Down the drain into a blind alley. I always was worried about the sequence. You go down the drain and then come up in the blind alley? Or what do you do? in any case, there are two sort of very different attitudes. The realist is not at all complacent by the inability to understand quantum theory in such a way that it gives a picture of what's going on. Einstein wants to be a realist, but says, well, you know, if you really have your back against the wall, maybe you can back off from that. Here's another quote from Weinberg in his recent lectures on quantum mechanics, where he seems to be expressing this alternative motivation. There's nothing absurd or inconsistent about the general idea that the state vector serves only as a predictor of probabilities, not a complete description of a physical system. Good thing, too, because that's what it does. Okay. Nevertheless, it would be disappointing if we had to give up the realist goal of finding a complete description of physical systems. So he's sort of feeling the urge to do something different, so we get that realism back. So I'm going to leave this to you as an open question. Is the demand for a complete description of physical systems, a picture of reality, any more defensible than the demand for a deterministic theory? Or are these both merely expressions of personal preference, mere metaphysical gut intuitions? I feel the metaphysical gut intuition, but I can't for the life of me justify it as a constraint on how physics should be done and what we should be after in physics. Is that demand for a picture of reality any more defensible than the demand for deterministic theory? Up to you. What do you think? Yeah.
Wayne?
Okay. Oh.
Okay. Suppose I have something weaker than a demand for a complete description.
Yes.
Suppose I merely want to know whether I can have a complete description.
Yes.
And I regard it as a useful research program to pursue the project, mm-hmm. because it seems to me the only way I can answer that is to try it and see if I can.
I encourage you to do so.
Do I have any reason to think that I can't
have a
complete description?
All that you should be aware of are the constraints that such a complete description has to, in the end, square with. And we know a lot about them now.
Yeah, I think we do. But so I asked myself, what kind of complete description was it? I find it hard to believe that such a description would not have the consequence that if I describe the world, God knew, describe the state of the system after, say, what we regard as a preparation in a singlet state, that God, someone in possession of such complete description would in fact be able to read off the quantum state from that complete description. So that's something that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there a nut in there, or
would
you would be able to do that?
Or anyone in possession of a complete description would be able to read off the quantum state.
That's part of my view, so I agree.
Okay, yeah. Then it seems that it's a psiontic view.
Okay.
What?
Psiontic view.
Okay.
Because that's what I counted as psi.
Oh, good.
Whatever the complete description of something is, the quantum state, is either included in that or supervenes on that.
Right. When you hear the quantum state, then I get a bit worried because there are different quantum states floating around here and different stuff that different quantum states supervene on.
Okay. I think I would agree with that, except that the picture I would have is something like what Daniel was presenting, that don't ask what the quantum state of a bounded space-time region, assign quantum states to entire Hartree surfaces.
Well, I would assign quantum states to systems. I wouldn't talk about space-time at all.
Bill? First thing is, I don't know how much of a conciliator you are, because
I knew I'd end up in the middle with mud slung from both sides.
No, in the sense that I think your position is very close to mine. So, but anyway, the other thing is, I don't know, people keep using this term, a complete description, and that we have a lack of a complete description, and I simply don't know what that means. And one of the things that it reminds me of was that if one looks at the history of dynamics, it was completely clear to everybody that objects moved because they were moved. They didn't just move on their own, but you always had to have something or other, who knows, little demons or whatever, continuing to keep pushing them to keep them moving. And then Newton came up with his theory of inertia, that objects just keep moving unless acted upon by an external force. And I can sort of imagine some of the medieval philosophers coming in. But, that's just not a complete description of the universe. I mean, I want to know what makes that arrow move. It moves, and you tell me that it just goes ahead and moves, but I want to know what makes it move. Where are those demons? Show me the demons in your theory. And it's not clear to me that this demand for a complete description of quantum mechanics isn't a search for those same demons that keep that arrow moving.
Mm-hmm. I could say something, but I would rather ask somebody else to say something in response to that, if anybody wants to.
Toward the end, you had the word, something about entailing classical
limits. Yes,
limit.
Right.
What are you happy with the idea that we quantize a classical system, and when we take the classical limit, we go back to that original classical theory?
In a sense, yes. In a sense, no. Here's the yes sense. If we apply quantum theory to the system you're describing, and then we take the limit, what quantum theory is going to be telling us is that it's perfectly fine to make meaningful claims about what to say in that limit. And moreover, you should assign a credence, a personal probability, indistinguishable from one to some of those claims at the expense of others. So if that's what it takes to recover classical physics, then yes. However, what you haven't done with quantum theory is to extract from quantum theory a description of the classical result. All you've done is extract from quantum theory the recommendation that you very strongly believe that that's the classical result. So in the sense of entailment, you don't have entailment, but you have in the earliest sense recovered the result.
Okay.
Maybe that's too subtle a distinction to care about.
Okay, I think that's close enough. In your second or third slide, you also said if quantum theory failed, that would be a significant situation too.
Yes.
But I claim it has failed.
Oh, okay.
And it is widely accepted in the particle world that the so-called classical scalar phi to the four theory in four dimensions mm-hmm. is, when quantized, becomes a free theory.
Mm-hmm.
Whose classical limit would be a free classical scalar theory, which was not the classical theory you started with.
Hmm.
And it is widely accepted mathematically even that in higher dimensions than 4, 5, 6 and more, that is a rigorous statement.
Mm-hmm.
The quantization of the nonlinear scalar field theory becomes a free quantum
hmm.
theory whose classical limit is again free classical theory,
mm-hmm.
different from your
mm-hmm.
original theory. So that's a violation of what I consider sacred
mm-hmm.
classical, go with the quantum,
mm-hmm.
classical limit should go back to the original theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in my judgment, a failure of quantization as we know it.
Right. I've never heard that before. I don't have any reaction on the spur of the moment, but I think it's very interesting.
Daniel, yes. There is no measurement problem because the state is something to give good authority advice about the properties.
Yes.
That the state can have. But the question is, what are these properties? What am I allowed
okay.
to describe as properties? The other day we were saying,
yeah.
I was listening to you,
mm-hmm.
and I said, well, suppose I tell you that the particle has this position and this momentum,
right.
you tell me this is not allowed.
That's not
so
allowed.
What are the properties, and when do something have properties? When do things have properties, and what kind of properties have? How do I codify that?
Excellent questions. What kinds of properties? Well, properties corresponding to having a position in a certain range, having a momentum in a certain range, having maybe in certain circumstances a precise energy. And so on, that kind of property. And maybe new properties that we don't know about yet as we continue to develop science. Okay, so those are the kinds of properties. But there are certain claims about such properties that are not cognitively significant in certain circumstances. For example, the claim that any system has a precise position and a precise momentum is not a claim that's cognitively significant in any circumstance. I'll tell you why it's not cognitively significant. It's not cognitively significant because cognitive significance attaches to claims by virtue of what you're entitled to infer from them and what you're entitled to infer them from. And the inferences that you're entitled to make from that are none, essentially. That's really bad position to be in, inferentially speaking. So you shouldn't attach any cognitive significance to that. Now, this is vague and fuzzy. And people who want precision get upset because it's vague and fuzzy. But I actually think that's an advantage because of the way I'm tying this vagueness and fuzziness to the vagueness and fuzziness that's already present in decoherence. We don't have a clear cutoff between yes, cognitively significant, and no, not cognitively significant. We have a gradual sort of increase in cognitive significance corresponding to a gradual increase in the extent of decoherence, which our wisely assigned quantum state advises us to use in this context. Okay. So there's not going to be any precision about which statements clearly have cognitively significance. There's not going to be any precision about exactly when you're entitled to apply the Born rule and exactly when you're not. But that's fine. I mean, decoherence is an incredibly efficient process, even though it's fuzzy. And we don't need that kind of precision in order to apply quantum theory. Now, somebody like Bell would still be upset. I acknowledge that. He wants precision here. But I would say to somebody like that, look, we have a precise formulation of the theory. The imprecision enters into the application of the theory. But whenever any theory is applied to any physical system, imprecision enters. So big deal. Does that satisfy you? I'm sure it doesn't, but if not, tell me why not. Yeah.
Yeah, but many questions about the non-locality stuff.
Yes.
Maybe I'll just ask a short one, then maybe a long
yeah.
one. So the first one, you said we shouldn't worry about it.
Yes.
And then you said, well, we should just maybe not look for causal explanations of these things,
yes.
and then it would be okay. But that's the thing you sort of say, well, we are worried about. So
okay.
we're worried because we want to be able to say, make causal explanations.
Right.
So we think it's
right.
more central to physics.
Right.
So can you comment
right.
on that?
Yeah, I don't see a way you can succeed in giving causal explanations in this scenario. If you do, I'll be the first to run up and ask you how you did it and be really impressed and be happy indeed.
Can I do a little one? Go ahead. So this one's a bit more aggressive question. So say I come, so you said that local causality is a condition on theories.
Yes.
Right? So I agree with that. So say I have Joe's crazy theory. So
okay.
Joe's crazy theory is like this, and it's all I can cast it all in the same kind of pragmatist language as your theory.
Right.
Alice is over here, and she's got some probability for an outcome,
right.
an upper outcome of some experiment she set up. Say it's a half probability,
mm-hmm.
and that's you know for her. I don't know how you describe agents, but for her agency, the probability is a half.
Yeah.
And then Bob's over there, and for her, it doesn't matter what he does because she doesn't know about it.
Right.
But say her probability now depends, instead of on his outcome for some Bell experiment,
mm-hmm.
it depends on his setting. So
mm-hmm.
he's got some setting, he changes it, and her outcome, say, perfectly correlated with it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can maybe use the same account of why you shouldn't apply local causality to that. And
mm-hmm.
say, hey, well, you know, I can just update Alice, everything, there's no way to, for locality, talk of local causality to get a foothold here,
mm-hmm.
so you shouldn't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's non-local signaling. I mean, there's
okay.
signaling
okay.
in that.
That's a really good
so,
question. I like
see,
that.
So,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
so that's,
yeah.
my try, that's my attention
mm-hmm.
to this
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And so you should consider.
Okay. Well, I think, okay, I think I accept that. I think that if that were the scenario, then the possibility of non-local signaling through that procedure would be a very strong temptation to gloss this causally.
Right.
And I think I would do that. But that's not the scenario we face in quantum theory.
But I'm saying that your account of why we shouldn't think of things, why we shouldn't apply Bell's local causality
right.
condition, it applies duly to both Joe's crazy theory and to quantum theory. So then,
well, be careful. The local causality condition itself doesn't mention anything like causation. If we apply quantum theory, we do so without ever mentioning causation. And if we apply quantum theory, the kind of statistical probabilistic correlation you're describing doesn't enter in, so we don't have to worry about it from the perspective of quantum theory.
No, wait,
if it did, we would have to worry about
wait.
It.
Well, I'm not saying, but I'm saying this is a, so the first thing's important, so local causality is a condition over theory, so it's not, so you
right.
can't just give you can't just give an account that's restricted to quantum theory, otherwise I could just define locality as
right.
quantum theory or something.
Right, right, right.
So if Joe's crazy theory and quantum theory are both things that we can try and apply
mm-hmm.
reasoning. We should be able to apply the argument to both of those things equally. If one of them's got superluminal signaling, but I can still apply your account and,
mm-hmm.
sort of, and
mm-hmm.
it seems to work there, then why should I trust it in the quantum place?
Well, I think I don't have a completely adequate answer to you right off the top of my head, but I want to pursue this later. But let me just say this much, that what I think is missing in attempts to gloss the counterfactual dependence between Alice's outcome and Bob's outcome as causal is the kind of asymmetry that I take to be built into our concept of causation, which has to do with the potential of intervening to bring about the effect by intervening at the cause. And this potential in a very, very weak sense. You know, we can't intervene in the early universe to make things be different, actually. And it's not mere technological impossibility, but we're in worse shape than that. So the potential to intervene is a very, very weak sense of potential. But it has to be there. And it has to be there to give you the asymmetry. And in the scenario that we were considering, it wasn't there. Okay, that would be the basis of an answer for not glossing this counterfactual dependence as causal. I don't think that's quite adequate, but let's pursue it later.
You should have, but
yeah. The best I could understand your account of how you try to explain the correlation only led me to understand that Allison Bob's expectations of the output
yes.
would be correlated.
Right.
But the correlations are stronger than that. And I didn't follow
yes.
how your account.
Okay. The additional claim was that. In order to get an explanation, they have to be able to show not merely that what happened is exactly what they would have expected, but also each of them has to be able to give an account of what the statistics depend on in this case. And Alice has an account of what they depend on. And what they depend on Alice's account is they depend on whatever conditions grounded the assignment of the initial Bell state. End of story. Okay. The statistics of Alice's outcomes, according to Bob, depend on something else. Namely, they depend on his outcome. Okay. So each of them is satisfied because they can say why Alice got the statistics she did. They can say why, each can say why he or she would have expected those statistics in the first place. And each of them can say what those statistics depended on. It's just that their stories as to what they depended on are different.
Yeah, okay.
So they're giving different explanations. And then again, if you say, well, which is the real explanation? Who's right? Isn't it really Bob because he's taking account of more information? That's a bad question. Yeah.
It still seems to me that this explains it at a statistical level.
Yes.
But I'm trying to, you know, just consider a single instance
okay.
where you have a correlated pair. It seems that it's still not sufficient to pin down how is it that Alice is
okay. Well, in one particular instance, if they have different angles, there is no explanation. If they happen to align them at the same angle, then we have perfect correlations or anti-correlations, depending how we set it up. So how do we explain the perfect correlation in the one instance? Then I think what we have to say is that's just what you should have expected on the basis of the assignment of the initial state and on the settings that were taken, where we're now taking a perspective different from both Alice and Bob's, because we're assuming as part of our information base what the actual settings were. And then you have to say, well, I would have expected that given the conditions that grounded the initial state and those settings, and what that correlation depended on was essentially what I just said, namely the settings and the whatever grounded the initial assignment of quantum state. That might not satisfy you as an explanation. It won't satisfy anybody who wants a continuous causal story as to what was going on.
No, my
yeah.
seems to be more that it sounds to me more like a deterministic explanation. So that
yeah.
if you take into account all the circumstances that went into the measurement
mm-hmm.
scenario in one particular instant, it sounds to me, and I maybe misunderstand
yeah.
what you're saying, that based on that, you should then be able to tell, you know, what the correlation. But that sounds like a deterministic explanation.
Okay. It's the limit case of a probabilistic information explanation. The limiting case in the sense that the probability is one. If you want to count that because the probability is one as being a deterministic explanation, then okay. I mean, you can't explain why Alice got up and Bob got up rather than both getting down. But what you can explain is the correlation. And you can explain that by showing each of them should have expected it in the circumstances I've described with probability one. And that counts as a prediction of quantum theory in the only sense in which quantum theory gives us predictions on this view. Is that deterministic? Well, it's not really deterministic because all that was issued from the theory was the recommendation that you assign a degree of belief one to this happening. Okay.
David, did you have...
It overlaps enough with questions that have already been asked, so okay. I don't need to take up more time.
Yeah, yeah. The theory is standard theory plus the instruction that I use Born rule when I have appropriate conditions which involve the coherence.
Yes.
But those conditions depend on what is the observer that is going to employ the theory. So you're saying when we have a well-defined theory and then we have problems when we try to apply
right.
it's not precise.
Right.
But the Born rule is connected with these imprecisions because the coherence is tied to what the observer is allowed to observe or
right.
is not allowed to,
right.
to observe. So it seems to me that the Born rule lies in this fuzzy region,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and therefore your theory, what is precise about your theory, does not include the Born rule or anything of that sort. Is that correct?
The conclusion is certainly not correct, because what's precise about the theory is the way we formulated the Born rule in quite precise terms. Okay. Because we didn't use terms like measurement and observation and all that stuff. We didn't use the term decoherence to apply.
You told me you saw it
in the Born rule. No. It's a subtle distinction. Maybe you think it doesn't matter, but here's the subtle distinction, right? You state the Born rule without talking anything about applications or decoherence or any of that stuff, right? But having stated it, the issue arises as to when you can apply it. And then, in order to know when you can apply it, then you need to start talking about things like decoherence, okay? And it's a judgment call on the basis of every physically situated agent based on a model of decoherence as to when that agent in that situation is entitled to apply the Born rule, okay? But that judgment call, I think, is analogous to the judgment call that always occurs when you're applying any physical theory. So the statement of the theory is perfectly precise. Its application requires judgment, but that's a big deal. We knew that.
So I think it's time to eat.
Okay.
Let's thank our speaker.